Q1.
An ordinance of the City Council of the City of Flagstaff, Arizona, amending Flagstaff City Code Title 14, Human Relations, by adding Chapter 2, Civil Rights.
It passed. Unanimously. I want to say thank you to all of you that appeared. I want to say thank you for the respect that you have shown.
All right. Are we like ready to roll here? What's going
on?
Well,
that's a little rocky as openings go on this show.
You know, well, hi everybody. How you doing? It is the Rebecca Juro Show. Starting out a little bit late tonight, but we are ready to rock and roll. We've got Toni Dorsey coming up at the end, at the bottom of the hour. And of course, she is involved with the Phoenix effort. That what the clip you just heard there was from Flagstaff, which just as you heard, unanimously passed a new ordinance to protect its LGBT citizens. So kudos to them. That's always great.
It's trans inclusive.
Indeed,
I had to make sure it absolutely is.
Yeah,
it's really a great bit of advocacy, Becky. Flagstaff's a pretty backward place in some ways. I'm telling you.
You've dealt with these people.
It's a heavy Mormon area up there. There are a lot of very conservative Republicans in the area, although it tends to skew more blue these days than red, which is a nice thing. And it has a university. NAU is up there. And I had a really difficult time when I lived in Flagstaff over 20 years ago now, doing a small FM radio station up there and having some really serious problems with some of the retail people. Not that were my customers, who were great, but, you know, like a Radio Shack in Flagstaff that I dropped several thousand dollars on threw me out one day, calling me a fucking faggot, and then changed their email list so that it would be coming to Mike Faggot Scott. Well, I think we got the guy fired, though. That was a good thing.
Nice. This is Flagstaff 20 years ago. Oh, so this is 20 years ago. So really quite a change there from when you were dealing with these folks. Hi, Mr. Mike.
Well, and 5 years ago, they tried to get a similar ordinance passed, and it was shot down. I think it was unanimous. And so you have a complete turnaround at the city council.
Interesting.
The current mayor, I understand, was a mayor back then, was not for it. And what happened, really great advocacy on a local level. They decided that they were going to hit two main issues. It was going to remind the local business community that it's going to be great for business.
Yeah.
Flagstaff's a real travel-oriented destination, and this is going to improve their tourism, it's generally felt. And also the fact that they had some really good personal testimony before the city council, really compelling, and I'd have to say very moving testimony of people's experiences of discrimination in the community, and that's what really grabbed my heart.
Yeah. So, of course, we should point out that Arizona has no state law whatsoever protecting LGBT people, has a governor that is certainly as right-wing as they come, mm-hmm. certainly is not going to sign anything that supports our community. So this is really... you know, it just goes to show you that we are making progress, that there's real definable progress being made here. And of course, we're going to get into that with Toni Dorsey in just a few minutes,
and
because
how to be a really great advocate in an aggressive situation where it's possible to win a situation that's really stacked against you. That's where this great advocacy comes in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And along those same lines, and of course, we'll go into more detail with this with Toni when we speak to her a little bit later. But along those same lines, one of the things that we've been seeing this week, which I'm very heartened by, because I think, you know, this shows that I think the activist community, the national activist community, is finally pulling their heads out of the sand and starting to really focus, is we're seeing a level of pressure on the Obama administration to get that LGBT protective executive order that would protect employees of federal contractors is ratcheting up. Just this week, we saw now 54 groups got together, 54 different groups got together, and now have sent a letter, just like the letter from the 37 senators last week that we saw. Now, 54 civil rights organizations got together to write a letter to President Obama. Let me give you here's some of the I think this comes from the Washington Blade. Forgive me if I've screwed it up, because I have several articles here, and only one of them's from the Blade, and there's from other places as well. But let me read some of the details here. A coalition of 54 groups is ramping up pressure for President Obama to sign a heavily sought-after executive order banning federal contractors from discriminating against LGBT workers. Now, in a letter dated February 20th, yesterday, a coalition of LGBT advocacy groups and other civil rights organizations, such as those representing the blacks and Latino communities, call on Obama to take administrative action to protecting, on protecting workers from anti-LGBT workplace bias. Now, one of the quotes from this letter: over the past 70 years, both Republican and Democratic presidents have used executive orders to ensure that taxpayer money is not wasted on workplace discrimination or harassment based on characteristics such as race, gender, and religion. These contractor policies exist to this day, and they cover almost one in four jobs throughout the United States. It is now time for an executive order ensuring the same workplace protection for LGBT Americans. Standalone legislation that would provide broader protections for LGBT people, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, ENDA, has languished in Congress for decades. But among the LGBT groups, which leaders put their name to this, are the Human Rights Campaign. Kudos to them. They deserve credit. And just as an aside, they have certainly been out in front on this. They deserve credit for that. And, you know, whatever our other problems with, they deserve credit on being out in front on this issue. Freedom to Work, of course, that's Tico Almeida's organization, who we've had on the show. Get Equal, we've had Heather Kronk, of course, from Get Equal on the show. They've all previously called for this. Now, Tico actually said, nearly 175,000 Americans have signed Freedom to Work's online petition asking President Obama to issue an executive order to save our taxpayer money from subsidizing workplace discrimination. We are grateful to the dozens of national organizations joining today's letter to urge the president that the time to act is now. Other groups that were signing on to this are the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, the liberal think tank, the Center for American Progress, and I encourage you, go to their site. The Center for American Progress has an awesome article that really makes the case. And all the facts and figures and all that stuff, highly recommend you. It's a long read, but it's a good one. And I strongly recommend you check that out. We also have, in addition, National Council for La Raza and Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Anthony Romero, executive director for the ACLU, said the executive order would build off existing policy and put in place to protect workers against discrimination in previous administrations. He said, by banning federal contractors from discriminating against LGBT Americans, President Obama would extend the commitment to non-discrimination first made by President Roosevelt more than 70 years ago when he signed an executive order integrating the nation's shipyards and other work sites run by defense contractors. Taking this action would result in at least some workplaces in all 50 states having legally binding protections for LGBT Americans, a first in our nation's history. Another signer, who we've had problems with in the past, back in 2004, we actually protested these guys because they weren't on board with an inclusive ENDA. The Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, which was then the Leadership Conference on Human Rights, I think, on Civil Rights, last week sent its own missive to Obama calling for the directive, saying issue an executive order to ban federal contractors from discriminating against LGBT employees helps promote equality for all individuals under the law. Now, one of the arguments of the letter is that most top government contractors, such as Boeing, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, already have non-discrimination policies in place protecting LGBT workers. And the new directive would primarily impact those holdout contractors that are still complicit in sanctioning anti-LGBT workplace discrimination or harassment. According to the statement accompanying the letter, 57% of government contractors already have these policies in place. A letter from this organization, from these organizations, excuse me, comes on the heels of another missive last week, as we reported last week, from 37 senators calling on Obama to issue the directive. It's also similar to a letter sent last year from 72 House Democrats saying the time is now. Calls on Obama to issue the executive order have intensified since Republicans took control of the House and passage of ENDA became unlikely. Unlikely as in impossible with Boehner. I mean, you know, I love the way they say unlikely. I mean, here's a guy who's using taxpayer money to defend the Defense of Marriage Act when the Obama administration refuses to defend it because they say it's unconstitutional. Okay, and they think that somehow there's some kind of small chance that that Boehner is going to introduce this and it's going to pass? I mean, on what planet? You know, I mean, I'm just saying, unlikely is, I think, too weak a term. More like about as likely as a gigantic meteor hitting hitting Russia. Oh, wait. in April, the White House announced, and just recently in response to the senator's letter, also confirmed that it wouldn't issue the directive at this time, is still pursuing a legislative solution to the issue. You know, and I'd like to pursue learning to fly and gliding over my hometown, but that's not going to happen either. You know, I mean, it really annoys me that the Obama administration thinks that this is a viable argument. Oh, yeah, we're hoping Congress will do something. I mean, whatever happened to, if Congress doesn't act, I will. Oh, well, we didn't mean you. We only meant the people that we need their votes, in 2014. You're going to vote for us anyway, so we're not going to do that for you. I mean, really, that's the argument that they seem to be making here. I think it's pretty offensive, quite frankly. Now, one thing is that's been more or less the message. However, the Washington Post did report last week that Obama is thinking about reversing that decision if lawmakers don't act. I mean, seriously, okay, don't get me wrong. I mean, Tom Harkin has already said that he's going to move into this year, and that's great. I mean, I hope it gets a vote in the full Senate. But anybody who thinks that this is going to get a vote in the House, and if it does get a vote in the House, it's going to pass, I think is kidding themselves. So, you know, I mean, I'm wondering if Obama is serious or if they're just leaking this because it's just more mealy-mouthed bullshit excuses for doing nothing, which is what Obama has been doing. Now, don't get me wrong. Every time I say something like this, everybody says, oh, well, you know, he's done this and he's done that and the hate crimes bill and housing regulations and blah, 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 blah. And you know what? That's all true. But it does, none of that stuff means anything unless you can get a job. What good are housing regulations unless you can pay the rent? I mean, seriously. Okay. What good is all this other stuff, the hospital regulations, unless you can afford to pay your hospital bill? I mean, seriously, you know what? I call it bullshit because it is bullshit. This is a president. He was a community organizer. He knows better. He knows better. Okay? And when Shin Inui, the White House spokesperson, panders this mealy-mouthed crap that says, well, we're hoping that Congress will take up this bill. And it's like, yeah, I'm hoping that too. I'm also hoping that suddenly I'll gain superpowers and be able to fly. But that's not going to happen either. I mean, really? Do they think we're stupid? Do they think we don't read the internet? Do they think we don't watch television? Do they think we don't pay attention to what's going on in the United States Congress? It's insulting. It's insulting that they think that these kind of mealy-mouthed answers are viable and that we believe them and that we consider them credible. It's bullshit. We know it's bullshit. I mean, really. I want to read... we're almost up to our first break. But let's see here. I think I have... Where is that letter? I thought I had it. There it is. Okay, here we go. I'm going to read the letter that was sent, and I'm going to read off these names real quick, and then we're going to go to break, and we'll bring on Tony, and we'll talk about Phoenix. Here it is. Of course, it's addressed to the president, and it says, executive order adding LGBT protections to millions of jobs. Dear Mr. President, we were deeply moved by the passage of your second inaugural address connecting Seneca Falls and Selma to Stonewall, and we agree that our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. Therefore, we write to urge you to take an immediate step towards legal equality by signing the executive order banning federal contractors from discriminating against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans. Over the past 70 years, both Republican and Democratic presidents have used executive orders to ensure that taxpayer money is not wasted on workplace discrimination or harassment based on characteristics such as race, gender, and religion. These contractor policies exist to this day, and they cover almost one in four jobs throughout the United States. It is now time for an executive order ensuring the same workplace protections for LGBT Americans. Most of the top government contractors, companies like Boeing, Raytheon. Okay, well, anyway, we read all this before. But it goes on like that. And basically, it says it finishes with a. I'll just finish with what it says here. Your record of accomplishment from your first term demonstrates your strong commitment to the principle that all Americans deserve a fair shot to succeed, regardless of who they are or whom they love. We urge you to begin your second term by taking strong executive action to prevent irrational workplace discrimination against LGBT Americans. The time to act is now. Sincerely. And I'm not going to read this whole list. But suffice it to say, there are some great organizations in here. Just a few before we go to break. ACLU, the Anti-Defamation League, Democracy for America, Freedom to Work, Family Equality Council, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, Get Equal, Human Rights Campaign, Lambda Legal, Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, NAACP. National Center for Lesbian Rights, National Center for Transgender Equality, National Council of Jewish Women, National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. It goes on and on and on and on. OutServe SLDN, People for the American Way, PFLAG National, Service Employees International Union. There's a bunch more, but we don't have time to go through all those because we got to get Tony on the line and talk about Phoenix. So we are going to go to Calpurnia Adams, who's very cool, and we're going to have her. Bitch of Burlesque is the song, and we will see you guys in five with Tony Dorsey.
Someone simply because they are gay or transgendered.
And that's why the organization One Community felt the need to start the Unity Pledge, a pledge that encourages Arizonans to stand up for diversity that includes the gay community. Mayor Greg Stanton, on hand for the event, kicked things off by signing the pledge himself.
And now we are officially kicked off.
For our economy to advance, for us to build the right kind of jobs, we need everyone to be a part of our future. And so a diverse community, a city that embraces it, that's great for our local economy.
According to one community, workplace discrimination against LGBT employees caused businesses $64 billion each year, not only hurting businesses, but our economy.
The organization says it hopes to have a minimum of 10,000 businesses sign the Unity Pledge and join the likes of this business, which already has, and send the message that it's time for equality for all employees, consumers, and residents.
Scott Kohler, the owner of Fast Signs on Central near Thomas, is among the first wave of business owners to get on board.
I signed it because it's not only the right thing to do, but it's good for business, it's good for my business, it's good for all business.
At the kickoff, Mayor Stanton also announced the city is working on making sure the LGBT community is treated equally.
In addition, I announced that the City of Phoenix is pushing forward with an ordinance, a non-discrimination ordinance, that would provide protections for LGBT residents.
Aurelia Ortega, 12 News.
We are back. It is the Rebecca Juro Show. Thanks for sticking around. And I believe we have Tonya Dorsey on the line. Tony, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, awesome. Well, you know, as we just heard from that clip, there's been a real effort in Phoenix. We heard about Flagstaff, which just passed their ordinance. Talk a little bit about the effort in Phoenix, where it is. We heard on that clip about there was a drive to bring businesses together and a unity pledge. Talk about how this effort is going.
Well, overall, the effort is going actually really, really well. This was a centerpiece of the mayor's campaign during the last election cycle locally, where he wanted to make sure that the trans community in particular, but the entire LGBT community, was protected from the sort of discrimination that we tend to face, especially within the Phoenix area. And that discrimination tends to be very low-key. This isn't a city where people walk up to you and say things to your face like that. This is one of those where, just to give an example from my own experience, I was evicted for being trans. I went into a place and I was going to pay my rent, and it was my first day of full time, so to speak. So the month before, I let them know that I was going to be this way, and they said my money was no longer welcome there.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So I'm wondering, because, you know, we heard, as Mr. Mike was saying earlier, that, you know, a few years ago, there was really a very strong anti-LGBT feeling in Flagstaff when he was dealing with those folks. Do you detect, like, is there a turnover? I mean, has the community in Phoenix progressed from what you're describing to what we're seeing now?
Well, I would say that there's definitely been an improvement, but traditionally and historically, Phoenix has kind of been like the middle ground between Tucson, which is like the liberal part of the state, and Flagstaff, which is the rural and generally much more conservative part of the state. So it's been like in between the two, and it kind of bounces back and forth between them.
Okay. And have you been getting a lot of pushback on this? Of course, we know that the state government, your governor, Jan Brewer, is not a fan. There are no statewide protections here, which is why these ordinances are necessary. Have you been getting any pushback from local residents?
Only this week. Most of this, although it's been a part of the agenda, it wasn't introduced to the Phoenix City Council, a full agenda, until really last week. Last week there was a meeting and a public hearing of the Phoenix City Human Relations Committee and then the Mayor's Council on Disability, which to combine together to vote yes recommendation, and that happened last week. That sent it to the City Council. So all of a sudden, now we're hearing that we're getting the news reports and the other stuff, and our local, anybody who's familiar with me knows I call them our opponents. Our local two opponent organizations, one of which is I believe they're now called the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is the old ADF. Their headquarters is in Scottsdale, which is a suburb of Phoenix. And then the Center for Arizona Policy, which is essentially the AFA's version here in Phoenix.
Interesting. Now, I noticed one of the things that I noticed was a lot of the major companies, businesses in the area, most notably in the article I'm reading here, PetSmart, which is based there. I actually used to work for out here in New Jersey. Was one of the companies that took this Unity Pledge. Do you think, was that useful, the Unity Pledge? You could get businesses on board with this thing. Do you think that helped to influence the outcome and is influencing the outcome?
I do think it is, especially in light of the two prongs of the attack, for lack of a better word, that the opponents are using. They're using a two-prong attack, and one of them is the very predictable small business attack. The responses of the trans organizations here and the wider LGBT have been on the basis of business. Phoenix generally likes to look at numbers and dollars, and it's always all about the money. So having that happen ahead of time, the Unity Pledge and the commitment to the diversity, which is a big deal here in Phoenix, which is really kind of a very strong democratic stronghold that people don't always think about in terms of Arizona. We've been very much at the lead in many ways in trying, especially of late, in trying to bring together the community and to build a more diverse base for that. We have an openly gay city council member. Uh-huh. He's actually our former vice mayor. And these things are really important. There's not so much of an issue with the cisgender LGB side of things. The rest of it is always, it's all about the T thing. We've kind of, you know, the community here has moved very much to that level. But on a person-to-person basis and in a daily sense, trans people actually don't have much difficulty with most businesses here. There's a lot of education. They're always open to education. They like it to be free, but they'll take it if it is. And there's, you know, there's a good, strong sense of, you know, you go do what you're going to do and get on with your life here in Phoenix. We have that. Arizona is known for its strong libertarian streak, and that's an impact of it.
I see. Okay. And how do you think that this is playing politically? I'm wondering because, as we know, those of us who don't live in the area, if I hear what we hear about Arizona through national news, we hear what we hear out here in Jersey and other areas that are far away. I mean, we hear the stories about, you know, the incredibly oppressive way that they treat immigrants and crazy sheriffs who want to put people in pink suits. And you know, we hear a lot of these far right, well, frankly, wackadoodle kind of stories, but what is it really? Talk to me a little bit about how is the average person? I mean, are they as conservative as the government action would seem to indicate, or is there really a progressive undercurrent? Or you know, how different is it? Let's say from Phoenix to Flagstaff to Tucson. You know, I mean, is it real? Is there a real difference there, or is there kind of a connection where the politicians are really out of step with where the average Arizona resident is?
To a great extent, the politicians themselves are very much in touch with their particular districts. Phoenix tends to cluster, and it's the way that people live and everything else, which is no different from most other places. We're just a really, really big city in terms of physical sheer size. Mm-hmm. And the different areas within the city, we have villages and all these other things that break it down. They generally are going to tend to be more center-right than center-left in Phoenix in particular. I'm going to say, based on my time down in Tucson, that Tucson tends to be a little more center-left, mm-hmm. and that Flagstaff tends to be a little further than center-right historically. I grew up in Sedona, which is a few miles south of Flag. And
very close to the studio here, where I
am. Yeah. Actually,
I
have family. And speaking of that, in Prescott, I have the old brick hotel. I can remember the Landmark, I think it's called.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
My family ties, which go back through northern Arizona, on the wall down near their lower-level restroom, they have the original paper where all of the investors signed on.
Oh, yes, I know.
Yeah, my grandfather's name is one of the.
Oh my goodness! Well, you're like one of our Prescott natives then.
Yeah, Prescott, Jerome, Sedona, Flag. We get it all. We're Northern Arizona here.
Yeah.
Well, very cool. Very cool. So now let me ask you before we move on, because there's something else I want to ask you about. But before we move on, what do you think? What do you expect to see going forward? Is this going to pass easily? Is it going to be a fight? What do you anticipate happening next?
Right now, I'm going to say, based on the work that's been done over the last several months to make this happen, that what we're going to see is a lot of complaints about the gender identity or expression and what that means at the public meeting on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And then I fully do expect it to go to a vote at the end of the meeting on Tuesday. And I'm guessing right now, I'll do a whip count and say it's around 5-4 in our favor.
Huh. Very cool. Very cool. So I get it. And is the city government, the actual, the mayor and those folks, do you think that there is enough momentum to carry it through and actually become law?
I do think there's enough momentum. Locally, we do have some concerns. You know, it could be 6-3, it could be 5-4 the other way. So there's a little bit of wiggle room in there that we're not super comfortable with. But we're going to try and show up in force and make sure that people understand and hear our stories and see be able to see the physical reality of what it means when our opponents say certain things and who it affects as an individual.
Okay, cool. Oh, we'll continue. Were you saying something?
No, I'm going to go ahead. I came to an end. I was going to try and wander off into more territory.
Okay. Well, I did want to ask you, there's something else. In addition to your work in Phoenix as an activist, you're also involved with something which I think is very interesting. It's a list called the Trans 100. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about this, describe what it is, And what it's about and you know, all that stuff like that there, which I'm talking about trailing off.
Not a problem. That Trans 100 is intended to be a list that gives us an idea of who the 100 most currently, at this moment, most effective or most powerful activists we have. It's the boots on the ground list. This isn't a list for, you know, the celebrities within the trans community. This is a list of these are the people who make a difference in the day-to-day lives of trans people on a real and significant basis. So as an example, and to just kind of throw an interesting thing in here, I don't think you would qualify.
I that's kind of what I assumed, because this is really, like you said, a boots on the ground activist. I'm kind of I'm a media person, and I, you know, hopefully speak to a lot of people over the internet. But I also I'm conscious of the fact that I'm out there promoting opinions and probably upsetting a few politicians here and there. And I don't think I'm frankly the best candidate to be an activist, and I wouldn't expect to be on that, because, you know, that's not what I do, really. I mean, I have done it and I will participate, and I've gone to Washington and done a few things like that, but I'm not really, I see myself more as somebody who tries to get the news out and tries to present as a media person and tries to bring people like you on to talk and to get these kind of information out to the public. So
exactly. Now, an interesting thing about the Trans 100 is the way that the list started was I actually got back into contact with my son for the first time in a little over 5 years. Hmm. And he had been basically stalking me online for 2 years. And one of the questions he asked me is, so, you know, you seem to be a pretty famous person. And I said, nah. I mean, if there was a list of 100 people, I'd be like 98, 99, maybe. And then that got me thinking, and I went to one group and posted an online group that I use, and I posted a little thing. I'm thinking of doing this list. Well, who would you nominate for it? And then that kind of got larger, and I went out on Facebook, and I posted a few things. And then I was contacted by Jim Richards. And so she and I had a long exchange, and we made it a partnership between our two organizations. Jim Richards is based in Chicago, and she's the operator and lead person, so to speak, of We Happy Trans.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's a great website, and they're a great group of people. I really like them. And then I am the executive director of This Is How in Phoenix, Arizona. And mm-hmm. so what we did, we put this together, this Trans 100 thing. We got together, we figured out how we were going to do it a little better, and we put it under our two organizations, so it's a partnership element between the two organizations.
Mm.
And
so
we're looking.
Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry.
So we're working to recognize people who do this kind of significant on-the-ground sort of work, and we want to get them from all over the country. And as a person of mixed racial background myself, it's important to me that we recognize, we do more than the typical list. We've all seen the Out 100. We've all seen it when the Advocate does a list or whatever. And often you see when they do include trans people, which, as you know, is always a challenge, they include, Hello, I'm here.
Oh, hi. No, it just lost me for a minute. Skype decided to have a little bit of a hiccup there. So go ahead. I apologize.
Not a problem. They'll include, the famous ones, the well-known ones. But a lot of times, they aren't the activists. They aren't the people who are making the significant change. I mean, a lot of us also know some of the bigger people, like Gunner in Massachusetts. But it's important that these people get recognized from all over the country. So we started asking for nominations, really pushed hard right after the Day of Remembrance. We officially closed nominations, although some have still been trickling in at the first. And we're going to release the list on the Trans Day of Visibility. Both Chicago and Phoenix are working together to do large Transgender Day of Visibility events on March 31st. And this is kind of like having a list of names that are available on that day to counteract the other day, because This Is How also does the Transgender Day of Remembrance here in Phoenix now. And we want to make sure that we have some sort of counterpoint to balance some of that out.
I see. Okay. And now, one of the things, I guess the first time I heard about this, the one thing that the question that immediately came to my mind was, are there 100 of us, or 100 trans people who would qualify for this? Because let's be honest, we're out there, but you don't see, as you were saying with the visibility, has always been an issue. And a lot of these folks I've always found are kind of working in the background. And so I wonder, I mean, are you having trouble filling out the entire list? Are there 100 people who qualify for this?
That was one of the other questions that we had in starting to put this together, and that was an early concern. And I said, when that question was raised, I said, oh, yeah, there's absolutely 100 of us out there. When you consider there's 1.2 million of them, and that's using a rather conservative concept of what it means to be a trans person, and a rather conservative number for the number of us, there's 1.2 million in the United States alone. Oh, heck yeah, there's going to be 100 of us doing the work out there. And that's part of the reason why the Trans 100 list is so important, is we don't know who they are. You know, if you're out in the middle of Alabama in, the hill country there, you're not going to know who to turn to, because nobody knows who's there, who's doing that work. And that's really the point of this list. It's to say, it's not a popularity contest. It's a contest of who's doing what. It's not going to be ranked. There's not going to be a number one and a number 100. It's going to be alphabetized, and we're going to do breakouts so that we can focus on African Americans, on Latino Americans, on Asian Pacific Islanders, on Native Americans. We're going to do breakouts for people who are working in the area of substance abuse, people who are working in the area of racial injustice, and these focuses within the trans community as a whole, so that we can say, you know what? If you need something, here's a person near you that does that. And it's really important, because we want this guide to be reaching out to the media people as well. And so it'll be available for free as a PDF. We're seriously considering doing a printed version of it, which is my personal goal. I would love to see a physical printed copy of it with images and the whole nine yards. And it's also going to have a website of its own, called thetrans100.com, nice and simple.
Yeah, I would hope that you do, because I mean, I was just thinking to myself that something like that would be very useful for somebody who does what I do, who I want to say, oh, well, you know, there's an effort in this state, and you know, I got in touch with you and said, talk to me about Phoenix. You know, and I could then turn around if there's an effort in another state to say, oh, here's somebody who I can contact and get on the show to talk about what's going on over here. I mean, so for someone like myself, I think that would be extraordinarily useful. And I'm hoping that the mainstream media would be more useful for that, although we don't see a lot of local activism coverage in the mainstream media, but you know, even stuff that's online and you know, folks who are reporting on those kind of issues, you know, local newspapers, local LGBT media, things like that, I think it would be extremely useful for them.
It will, and it will also enable more mainstream media coverage at the local level. Just discussing media coverage with people here locally in the mainstream press, and you know, for lack of a better term, in the street press here, and mm-hmm. they didn't even know that there were trans organizations. They don't know what trans people are facing here, and that's been one of my major roles and one of my major goals as the executive director of This Is How, is to make that possible. And that kind of fed into a lot of the considerations that went into developing the Trans 100 list. And then the other important thing that a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, I do this work myself. I'm a boots-on-the-ground activist that does more than just the political stuff. In fact, the political stuff is a very small part of what I do. Most of what I do is social justice and social work, actually. And so what we're dealing with there is we have this huge need, all these systemic issues, and sometimes it would be nice for me to be able to reach out and say, hey, here's an idea. This thing that I tried didn't work. Has anybody tried anything like this, and does it work? But we don't have that form of connection because nobody's been able to identify us. You know, we have within the community that desire to not necessarily be very visible, but anybody doing this kind of work, for the most part, wants to be visible. And the Trans 100 list means that they're going to be visible, and it gives them the ability to contact each other. It gives media the contact that they've been looking for locally, that they can turn to, and so it'll slowly shift our reliance on, you know, a handful, and you know, we could probably name all of the top 10 trans people on the two hands that have existed in the media in the last decade, and we want to be able to bring them all together and say, hey, you're not the only people out there, and it'll give more voices and bring up more color within the community itself, which is important to me.
I really agree with you. I mean, I know that, you know, on some occasions, you know, there are events like Creating Change and some other national events where trans activists meet, but there are very few where trans activists just, you know, as opposed to things like Southern Comfort and things that are more general and not really activist focused, and it doesn't seem like, and maybe, you know, it's the relative amount of money that trans activists have to spend and things like that. But for example, I'm going to an event this weekend in Philadelphia called the LGBT Media Convening, which is LGBT media bloggers and professional journalists, and we're getting together to talk about issues and stuff. And I would love to see something like that with the trans community and the activists and people who are, you know, even maybe the activists and our media getting together to say, how do we best promote these issues in the mainstream and to the general public and to our own community, for that matter, because I think we have issues there as well.
Oh, we absolutely do. When I try to break down my list of jobs that I do here locally, I'm going to say at least a quarter of my actual physical time is spent educating the trans community members themselves about themselves. And not everybody agrees with what I write, but...
Yeah, I know a little bit about that, too.
I do put on the dissonance hat still every now and then, but for the most part...
Well, you know, I mean, I've said this on the air a bunch of times. When I used to write for other publications, I used to get I once wrote, one of the first places I wrote was called Transgender Forum, and I used to get letters, angry letters from trans people who are, I think, I'm not sure, but I think mainly cross-dressers. And they would write me, oh, you're bashing George Bush. How dare you? He's wonderful. He's great. He's this, is that. You know, I'm like, you do realize who you're fighting for here. And you do realize that you're acting against your own interests. And I think a lot of people don't make that connection. They're like, oh, well, I support the Republicans on taxes. I support them on spending. But, you know, you're also supporting that. That means that if you're voting for these folks, you're also voting against your own interests as a trans person. And I think that there's a lot of people who don't make that connection.
Yeah, very much so. There are times when a lot of people think that I'm, you know, either very, very liberal or very, very conservative, depending on what they read that day. And I'm very much more in the middle of the spectrum there. I was a Republican for most of my life, and I switched over to the Democrats as the Republican Party shifted further right than I was, and the Democrats followed suit. So I was really more aligned with the Democrat Party. But that's a matter of, you know, something outside myself. My own political views are much more mainstream and much more middle of the road, because that's kind of what I have to be in order to do my main work. I have to be able to reach people without placing them on the defensive. I have to be able to reach people where they live. So that means I need to understand the kinds of forces that affect how they think and so forth. And if I go off on that path, I get way too much dissonance in the big words and stuff. So
yeah, I can understand that. Let me ask you one more question before I let you go. One of the things that we need to do is we need to cast civil rights in general, workplace rights, trans rights, LGBT rights, you know, this whole thing, is more of a mainstream issue. In other words, it's more of a mainstream value that people should be working. They should be able to, you know, if you work hard, you're able to have a good life, and more of a, you know, conservative. That's one of the reasons I never got the whole anti-gay marriage thing. You would think that, you know, people would be more interested in getting these so-called radical people into stable relationships and good jobs and more like them. But it doesn't seem to work that way, because it seems like the Bible gets in the way too often, I think.
It's not so much that it gets in the way, it's the particular interpretation people have of it. But yeah, there's an approach coming out of the social science fields right now that indicates there's a different way to reach a liberal audience than there is to reach a conservative audience. And when you look at the two of impacts, you can have almost immediate success with a liberal audience using one form of communication known as harm and care as an ethical basis for arguments, and then but you lose the conservative side. On the flip part of it, though, you can go towards a conservative argument, and you're going to have much more success with both sides if you use what's called a purity, an innocence argument. And, or that's not quite it, but that's a little work for now. And it's kind of a purity approach actually has much more impact, but it's also much more effective on a one-to-one scale, given that, you know, within the conservative community, they've really battened down the hatches. They're in a very defensive posture, and they've circled their wagons, and they all listen to each other. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of external information coming in there. And so if you're going to reach them at that point, you have to go to them where they live and how they think. And it's very manipulative, and it's very subversive, but the truth is that's how you get to them, and you bring them over to your side.
Fox News knows that rather well.
Yes, they do. They orchestrated most of it.
Yes, they did.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Tony, I want to say thank you. You are terrific. I hope we can have you on again soon, because this has been an awesome conversation. I'm loving this. Oh, my goodness. But we're out of time. So I want to say thanks, and we'll have you on again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye now. All right. And that was Antonia Dorsey, Phoenix activist, and awesome. I mean, wasn't that awesome, Mr. Mike? Wasn't she awesome?
Oh, I love that. Well, getting into the way messages work sometimes, I think they've discovered that conservative brains are wired different from liberal brains, for instance. And
yeah.
This philosophy comes out of that a little bit. Of course, Fox News has done a lot of research, I'll bet you, in some executive suite or some research department at Fox, they know how to get that message out really, really well. And it comes down to people's brains being different, the way it works.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. It is time for our top of the hour break. We have got Marcy Free and Secrets. We'll catch you in about five, gang. Sticking around, and wow, wasn't Toni Dorsey great? She was awesome. If you happen to have missed that interview, be sure to check it out on the rebroadcast, which comes right 5 minutes after we finish up here live.
Or our lovely podcast.
Indeed, absolutely. And we should point out, speaking of lovely podcasts, that we've got two more. The last couple of shows are now up. So you can check them out either through iTunes. Just look me up on iTunes. Or you can go to BeckyJuro.podomatic.com and get them there. And good
three
shows.
Three pods,
shows.
No waiting. Fantastic.
Yeah. Plus, we got Leslie Mariah Andrews coming up next week on the show. She hosts a show, a trans show, which I don't have her information in front of me, so I can't give you more than that. But you'll get more. You'll get more. Look at that on Facebook. Tony's saying, so for those who listen, how was I? And I'm going to write right as I'm talking now. So if she's still listening, she can hear me. I'm going to say, you were awesome. There we go. Bing. Okay. Anyway, moving on. There was another story I wanted to cover this week. I thought this was interesting. I saw this on the Huffington Post. Now, let me just find this. Ah, here we go. There's this high school senior who's going to prom and wants to wear a dress. Wants to wear a dress and heels and a wig, which is, you know, it's interesting because I'm not sure if this is a person who is a cross-dresser or a bona fide transsexual. And we have a clip from a news report. Mr. Mike, why don't you run that?
In 2013, it is still perfectly legal to fire.
Well, we wrong one. That is not
problem.
It.
Oh, dear.
That's not the one.
I got to push the right button here. I think I got it here. Let's try this one. Why is not? It's not playing. It's not playing, Becky. I don't know what I'm going to do. Oh, I see what's wrong.
Oh, okay.
Boy, this show is going to take a lot of editing, isn't it?
It's the Rebecca Giroux Show, always an adventure.
Should we always edit out our mistakes, though? Maybe that's the big charm of the show, or some of the charm of the show.
Well, who knows?
Is crazy producer's mistakes. I think we got it now.
It's live radio. I wore my total ensemble to Miller Outdoor Theater.
This wardrobe belongs to him. High school senior Tony Zamazal says he's been wearing the head-to-toe attire as often as he can.
I really didn't accept it in my own mind that that was okay until here recently, and it just became part of me.
Zamazal says he feels more comfortable dressing as a woman, and he was ready to make his big debut at prom.
When I asked if there was any way possible that I could, he just told me no.
He says an assistant principal at Spring High School in charge of prom dress code isn't willing to budge.
He told me that it was... It just wasn't in the dress code that women wore dresses, men wore tuxedos, that they had a standard dress code.
What sort of letdown did you feel when you were told, no, you can't do this?
It was crushing.
Zamazal says he initially felt defeated. Now he's ready to take a stand.
If I do get to go as a woman, I will be ecstatic.
All right. And I'll tell you, I have to tell you, I'm kind of torn about this particular person, because what you don't hear in this report is whether we're talking about a guy who likes to dress as a woman, or a person, a transsexual, who has a female identity and is expressing that through their physical expression.
They didn't ask the right questions.
No, they didn't. And I think that's an issue. And I commented on this on the Huffington Post, and I'll read what I wrote. This is my comment that I left on the Huffington Post. What isn't made clear from this report is whether this high school teen actually identifies as female, feels themselves to be transsexual, or simply enjoys dressing in women's clothes, is a cross-dresser. Given that the teen appears in male attire in the interview, which we played some audio from, he actually appears in jeans and a t-shirt and a very masculine haircut, and doesn't proclaim a female identity, I tend to believe the latter. While I fully support the right of anyone to physically present themselves in concert with the self-image that feels right to them, at the same time, I'm less supportive in general. Of a male-identified teen who wants to wear a dress at a school function than I would be of a male-born but female-identified teen who wants to present herself as the girl she genuinely believes herself to be. If those of us who are genuinely transsexual, or at least believe ourselves to be, want full acceptance and recognition in our chosen genders, I don't believe it's unfair to draw a distinction between those of us who see our transgender expression as a genuine reflection of how we see ourselves and wish to live our lives 24/7, 365, and those who simply enjoy cross-dressing as a hobby and or a way to socialize. While that may seem harsh and unfair on its face, the political aspects and realities have to be taken into account. Transsexual men and women are not cross-dressers, and being seen as such often hurts us politically in the still unfinished fight for full social, legal, and political recognition. That's what I wrote. And I got a few comments on this, which I'm not going to read because they're not mine, and I don't feel it's appropriate to read these personal comments. You know, reading articles that are published online is one thing. Reading personal comments is another. But in any case, that's kind of, you know, I'm really torn about this because, you know, on the one hand, I feel like if you want to express yourself in a certain way, you know, in terms of your gender presentation, in terms of your self-expression, I'm all for that. I mean, who am I to lecture somebody else on how they should appear to others? But at the same time, I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong with dress codes that say that women, females, or those who identify as female, and I include trans women and trans girls in that category, present themselves in a certain way in a public setting like a school. And those who are just doing it because they are doing it as a hobby, because they're cross-dressing. And I think there's a difference there, because if you want to be credible in the political arena, one of the most common attacks that we get from the right is, oh, you know, so-and-so is going to want to appear as a woman one day and as a man the next. And we try to argue, no, that's not what we're about. We're living these lives. This is who we are. But if you include a cross-dresser, somebody who literally looks like a woman one day and then looks like a man the next, or vice versa, who goes, you know, the people we call, well, it's kind of a snarky term, but I'll use it anyway, weekend warriors, you know, the folks who get dressed up on the weekends because they enjoy it, because they want to socialize and explore that aspect of themselves. And that's not a condemnation in any way. But they're also not going to work like that. They don't have to fight for their civil rights, in the sense that when they go to work, you know, they may wear a dress on Sunday, but Monday morning when they're going to work, they put on that tie and the suit and they go to work as a man, and they identify, and I'm using male to female and as, because let's be honest, most cross-dressers, most, are male to female. It's not considered cross-dressing for a woman to wear masculine clothes, at least generally not, because it's the range of women's clothes is far greater. You see women wearing ties. You see women wearing masculine tailored suits. And it's considered acceptable within the range of standard female expression. So when you're really talking about a cross-dresser, you're talking about something more blatant, such as a woman or a male-identified person in a dress, which is clearly a cross-dressing kind of thing if you're not living that. It's another thing if you're saying, this is who I am. This is how I want to live my life every day. This is where, you know, I have my female body image and mental image of myself, and that's how I am presenting myself to the world every single day. And if we're to be credible on that politically, then we have to be able to draw the line and say, this is who we are. And to turn around and say, oh, but we also include these folks who get dressed every now and then, and maybe they'll show up for work one day in a skirt and maybe the next day in a suit and tie, that undercuts our political argument. And I have no issue. I don't think it should be illegal or looked down upon or anything like that when somebody is a cross-dresser. But it's not the same thing. People who are cross-dressers don't need specific laws to protect them. Although there are, I should correct myself there. I should hold up. I should correct myself. In a lot of cases, it shouldn't be held against them because they happen to cross-dress on the weekends. Although we all know that there have been situations and there have been times when that has been true. The Peter Euler case, where a guy who cross-dressed on the weekends worked for Winn-Dixie as a trucker and lost his job because that was found out. So, I mean, it's not like there's never a reason to protect those folks. But generally speaking, they don't go to work and they don't present themselves in their daily lives in a transgender manner. And that's the difference, because if you want to protect the people who do, the people who are saying, yes, I was born male, but I live as a woman and I work as a woman and I live my daily life every day as a woman, it's necessary, at least at this time, it's necessary to say, this is who we are. These are the people who most need your protection, because we can't make a living. We can't support our families. We can't put food on the table without it. Whereas someone who cross-dresses, if they decide that life's getting too rough as a crossdresser, or that they wanted to go do something where that would be less accepted or inconvenient, or any one of a dozen other reasons, they can simply take the dress off, hang it in the closet, and go put on a suit and tie. We don't do that. We don't have that option. Or at least we don't, if we're living true to ourselves, we don't have that option. Now, I mean, we know also that there are people, I know of a few myself, who have actually live in states where their gender identity is not legally accepted. In fact, that's most of the country. And they've actually gotten married by identifying themselves by their birth gender so that they can marry a woman. And essentially, they're in a lesbian relationship, but legally, they're allowing themselves to be identified as male in their legal documents in order to facilitate getting that legal documentation. Now, that's something that each and every individual person has to decide for themselves. But the reality is, at least in my opinion, that if you are a woman, if you believe yourself to be a woman, well, then you're always a woman. And you're not a woman when it's convenient, but a man when it becomes inconvenient. And I think there's reason to question that. And does that mean that the person in question is automatically a crossdresser? No, of course not. Of course not. But doesn't mean that they're a transsexual either. And if you're going to protect people politically, at least at first, you got to go with the people who most need those protections. You know, I mean, call me selfish if you want. I'll take it. If that's what you see it as, well, call it whatever you want. But the reality is I'm going to present myself as a woman when I go to apply for a job, when I go to the local store, when I show up at a club or a restaurant or anywhere else that I go. That's who I am. I don't regress, well, for me it would be regressing, into male mode, which I haven't done in it's going on 16 years now. You know, it's a different type of gender expression. It's not any less valid, but it is different. And I think if you're going to focus on protecting people from discrimination, you go with the people who are most oppressed. And I think that's transsexuals. Those are people who live 24/7. Notice I did not mention the word surgery in there, because frankly, I don't think that's relevant. I don't think it's relevant to say what you have under your skirt or your jeans determines your gender. It may determine your biological sex, but it does not determine your gender. And your gender is what you present to the world in your daily life. Now, you can argue, and I think it would be fair to argue, that these folks who cross-dress on weekends or when they get together with friends or whatever have a non-standard gender identity. But it's not the same as somebody who is born in one specific gender and transitions to live full time in another. It's not the same thing. It's just not. And I am less, how to put this? This is a tough one. I don't want to get myself into trouble here, but I am less enthusiastic about supporting rights that include someone who's going to show up as a woman one day and show up as a man another day, because that, I do believe, can in some quarters affect people's businesses, how they're perceived, and it can cause problems. And I think a lot of crossdressers are aware of this, and they don't they don't present that way at work because they know that, you know, if they were Bob last week at work, then they're going to be Bob this week at work. And if they're Betty on the weekend, well, then that's their business. And it should be their business. But I think when you're comparing crossdressers to transsexuals, it may on the surface look like there's some similarities there, but you're really comparing apples and oranges. You know, and I will be the last person to say, well, we should protect these people, but not those people. But I do think that when you're talking about where the most urgent need is, who you should be protecting first and foremost, I think you have to watch out. I think you have to look at the people who are living these lives 24/7. Okay, just like a gay person does not go back to being straight when it becomes inconvenient, although, I mean, you know, the closet, you know, we hear all the stories about the closet. I mean, essentially, that's what it is you're masquerading as a straight person if you're, you know, because you're a minority. And if you don't identify as that minority, do you know what I mean? If you don't identify as that minority, then you're essentially hiding. You're in the closet and you're not identifying. Whereas somebody who is living, and particularly with trans women, where we're pretty obvious. We are. I mean, let's be honest. We don't all look like Laverne Cox and Janet Mock and you know, these beautiful trans women who you would never know unless they told you. Well, most of us don't. Most of us are not that level. We don't have these amazing figures and we look a little different. And so we wear that 24/7. And so we can't avoid, there is no closet for us. We can't go into the closet because the day you come out of the closet is the day you begin representing yourself as the person you are and living full time for most of us. I mean, sure, there are some, and with trans men, I think it's a lot different because, of course, they can grow beards and their voices change and it's much easier for those folks to, you know, woodwork, mainstream. You know, and I think when you're talking about somebody like this high school student who apparently seems to be just, I want to wear these clothes and I want everybody else to deal with it. I don't have a problem with that as an issue, but I do think that it's different. It's not the same thing as saying, you know, we're not going to accept a transgender identity of someone who feels themselves to be female and wants to live that way for the rest of their lives. It's not the same as saying, oh, I want to wear a dress to the prom, but I'm still a guy. I think that's different. It's got to be different. And I think we have to insist that until we have true political equality, that we keep pointing out that difference. All right. It is time for our next break. We have got another Calpurnia Adams tune, and her song is All the Pretty Horses, not to be confused with the group From Venus to Mars. This is her song, All the Pretty Horses. We will catch you in about 5 minutes.
Ha ha, your mushrooms are gone. Cute one.
Oh,
It's the Rebecca Juro Show. Thanks for sticking around. And, covered a lot of stuff tonight. Let's see. What else do we have to talk about today? Let's see. There's a bunch of things. I thought this was interesting. It's just a couple of short stuff. Tammy Baldwin is supporting Chuck Hagel as the next defense secretary, despite the fact that this guy has made notoriously anti-gay comments, called James Hormel, ambassador candidate James Hormel, aggressively gay. Baldwin said that she had met with Chuck Hagel, praised him for the humility to admit mistakes and learn from them. Of course, as you may know, on Valentine's Day, Senate Republicans, at least temporarily, stalled Hagel's nomination. They basically filibustered him, which has never been done in the history of the United States politics, of federal politics. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Okay. These people are nuts. I swear to God.
You just noticed, of course, that?
Yeah. They keep proving it over and over and over.
They're saying that the Tea Party just had to have their way because that's what they wanted to do. The tail is wagging the dog of the Republican Party.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Totally. Another interesting little thing was the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW, they filed a friend of the court brief in the United States versus Windsor, which is a lawsuit before the Supreme Court challenging the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act. CREW's brief, apparently co-authored with George Washington University law professor Alan Morrison, points out the effects DOMA has on ethics, tax, bankruptcy laws by recognizing only opposite-sex marriages. So kudos to them. Here in New Jersey, Senator Frank Lautenberg, who's been our senator on and off for decades, at one point he retired, and then when we had another Democrat, Robert Torricelli, went to jail for ethics violations and I don't remember. It was all kinds of bad stuff. I think he went to jail over this. Lautenberg ran again and was reelected. He's currently the Senate's oldest member at 89 and the last World War II vet who serves in the Senate right now. And he's decided not to run. Chad Griffin, HRC president, said in a statement, Lautenberg has been a steadfast advocate, a longtime leader on issues of LGBT equality in the Senate. During his tenure, he was a strong supporter of the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act, opposed codification of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 1993, and strongly supported the repeal in 2010. Yeah. He's a good guy on our issues. He was one of the people who also signed the letter to President Obama. He was one of the 37 senators, along with our other senator, Bob Menendez, who's facing some ethics issues of his own. And it's good to hear because, you know, Frank Lautenberg, he's a good guy. He's been our senator for a long time. We never had a problem with him politically. But you know what? If he ran again, the man would be serving until he's 96 years old. You reach a point where you want to say, you know what? Dude, it's time to retire. Okay. Now, what's more interesting, and it's not included in this little news blurb, is that Cory Booker, as in Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker, is seriously contemplating a run for that Senate seat, which I expect he will win. Frankly, I would have liked to have seen him take on Chris Christie for the governorship this year. But with Christie having a 73% approval rating at the moment because he did some good stuff with Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, Booker is probably making the smart political choice to go for the office that he's most likely to win. Personally, I think he would be a better governor because he's a real hands-on kind of guy. And being governor of this state is a hands-on kind of job, quite frankly. In Nebraska, A judge has rescheduled the sentencing date for Charlie Rogers, a woman who pleaded no contest to faking an anti-gay hate crime, according to the Sioux City Journal. Rogers will now face sentencing on March 14th in Lancaster County Court. Rogers was charged after she claimed she was attacked by three men who carved anti-gay slurs into her arms and stomach. Authorities later charged her with filing a false report, which is a misdemeanor. She could receive up to a year in jail and a $1,000 fine. As we talked about earlier, President Obama, of course, facing increased pressure to sign that executive order. You know, it's interesting, you know, how the pressure is starting to mount. We got the 37 senators, we've got 54 civil rights organizations, all saying the same thing. It's like, Mr. President, wake the hell up, man. It's like, you know, it's so funny. You know, you remember the old Franklin Delano Roosevelt line where you know, he was talking to activists who wanted certain things, and he said, make me do it. I mean, what do we have to do? You know, it doesn't matter what we do. They just he just refuses to do it. And I'll ask the same question that I asked last week on this show. Who exactly is he protecting? There's only one possible answer, and that's big business. He's not helping the gay community because marriage, the repeal of DOMA, that's going nowhere. Until the Supreme Court rules sometime over the summer, that's nowhere. That's no politician on either side of the aisle is going to touch that because they might be overruled by the Supreme Court. So until there's a decision there, it's going nowhere, and they know it. I mean, so who is he protecting? He's not protecting trans people. He's not protecting gay people. He's not protecting working class families. So who is he protecting? Well, there's only one possible answer, and that is he's protecting big business. Who benefits from this? Federal contractors, the 47% of federal contractors who are still refusing to implement these anti-discrimination laws. Most of the Fortune 500 already have them. 53% of the federal contractors already have them. So who is this guy protecting? It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Okay. PFLAG National will honor NFL players Brendan Ian Badejo of the Baltimore Ravens and Chris Cluey of the Minnesota Vikings, as well as award-winning author John Irving, at the 5th Annual Straight for Equality Awards Gala in New York City, according to a press release. Abendejo and Cluey have been staunch marriage equality supporters. In 2012, Irving released a book, One Person, in which the hero of the novel is a bisexual man, and the people he heroizes are two transgender women. Ooh, that sounds interesting. I might have to read that one. In a statement, Army veteran and OutServe SLDN Executive Director Allison Robinson praised the introduction of the Charlie Morgan Military Spouses Fund, an Equal Treatment Act of 2013, Senate companion bill to the Military Spouses Equal Treatment Act of 2013. The act would change the definition of spouse in four areas of the U.S. Code related to recognition, support, and benefits for married trans service members and veterans. Robinson said, in part, equality for LGBT troops and their families is a national security issue. Morgan, a chief warrant officer in the New Hampshire Army National Guard, fought to help her wife to receive benefits, and unfortunately she died February 10th of breast cancer at the age of 48. Now, let's see, what else? Now there's growing speculation that President Obama will name California Assembly Speaker John Perez as the next labor secretary. Of course, according to SDGLN.com, I have no idea what that is, but okay. If chosen, Perez would become the first out person to name to a cabinet level post in a presidential administration. His departure from Sacramento would also set off a scramble for his successor in the powerful legislative post that he's held since March 1st, 2010. He's the first out person to be Assembly Speaker in California and one of the few LGBT legislators nationally to serve in the top leadership post of their respective legislative chambers. I will also point out that John Perez was also the only Democrat at the DNCC convention last year to have a speech that focused on workplace rights instead of marriage. The only Democrat to do that. Needless to say, that never made it into the mainstream media, but you know what? We should remember that. Maybe he'll help convince our president to get that executive order done, because clearly he's got the right attitude and has the right priorities. So hopefully he will get through Congress. See, that's the other issue. Oh, he's gay. He can possibly get through the Senate. If Chuck Hagel can't get through the Senate, what makes you think this guy is going to get through? Can anyone say recess appointment? I knew that you could. The percentage of, here's an interesting little tidbit. The percentage of U.S. adults in the United States who identify as LGBT ranges from 1.7% in North Dakota to 5.1% in Hawaii and 10% in the District of Columbia, according to findings from a new study released by the Williams Institute. Distinguished scholar Gary Gates and Gallup editor-in-chief Frank Newport. The study is the largest population-based survey ever conducted that includes measurement of LGBT identification. Most states are within 2 percentage points of the nationwide average of 3.5%. February 15th, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education issued comprehensive guidelines that aim to ensure Massachusetts public schools comply with the new transgender non-discrimination law that bans discrimination against transgender students in all school programs and activities, according to a GLAAD, that's GLAAD, not GLAAD, .org press release. Among the areas the guidelines address are proper use of names and pronouns, privacy and confidentiality, physical education, and athletic participation. Let's see. What else should we talk about here? An openly gay Missouri teenager has won the right to attend a high school prom with his boyfriend after threatening legal action, according to NBC News. Stacy Dawson, a 17-year-old senior at Scott County Central High in Sikeston, had been told last year that he couldn't bring his boyfriend. On Valentine's Day, Dawson had the Southern Poverty Law Center send a letter to Scott County Central High and the school district threatening legal action. One day later, the district said it had removed a line. It had removed a line in the school handbook that reportedly prevented Dawson from bringing his boyfriend. Here's another interesting little tidbit. In Ohio, Pomeroy Mayor Mary McAngus resigned over accusations that she repeatedly called a gay police officer queer in front of his colleagues and created a hostile work environment, Fox News has reported. Police Chief Mark Prophet told the council this week that McAngus, 78, referred to Officer Kyle Callandine as queer in front of other officers and dispatchers. He says at one point she said, "I don't like a queer working for the village." Lovely. Lovely. Let's see.
We don't like your kind here.
Yeah. All right, here's an interesting little tidbit. As if you couldn't suspect that this one was coming. Former U.S. Senator Scott Brown, as in he of Massachusetts, who replaced Kennedy because the Democrat running against him was an idiot and didn't campaign well.
There you go.
And was just a bad, bad, bad candidate.
What a bad move that was.
He's joined Fox News. Scott Brown will be appearing on the Sean Hannity Show Wednesdays in primetime. In November, he lost the Senate race to Elizabeth Warren. He recently decided not to run for John Kerry's seat when Kerry was appointed Secretary of State. Brown will be joining believe it or not, this to me was just stunning. He will be joining former Democratic presidential candidate, wait for it, Dennis Kucinich.
What?
Yes, I kid you not. As a new contributor to Fox, as Sarah Palin and Dick Morris have left the network.
Oh, that bowls me over. How could that possibly be? Are they trying to be mainstream or normal, like an actual news station? How could that be?
I guess they're finally reaching a point where even their own audience is saying, you know, are you serious? And here's another interesting little tidbit in the way of who's joining who. David Axelrod, as in the president's advisor and senior strategist for both of his presidential campaigns, is joining MSNBC and NBC News as a senior political analyst. And what's even more interesting is another person who has just joined MSNBC and NBC News, Robert Gibbs, as in former press secretary to Obama press secretary, Robert Gibbs. What's interesting here is that, you know, one of the most common criticisms against MSNBC is they're like totally in the pocket of the Obama administration.
Well, this doesn't exactly change that perception.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, it's like, who's next? Are they going to get Michelle on the air too? I mean, you know, it's like, you know, they're so totally in the pot. I have to tell you, I think there's some credibility there. You know, isn't it interesting that when Democrats are lining up one after the other to say how much they support gay marriage, there's plenty of gay marriage coverage on MSNBC. But when they're running scared from ENDA and the ENDA executive order, well, then they got nothing to say. Or when they do say something, they get it wrong. Like, for example, on the 14th, on Valentine's Day, Lawrence O'Donnell on his page, I shouldn't say he personally, but one of his staffers on his page, put out a post about the 37 senators who signed on to the letter asking President Obama to sign the executive order. Except the problem was the staffer obviously didn't pay attention to what they were asking for. And they said, hey, wait a minute, let me see if I can find this thing. I want to read it exactly because this is really, you got to wonder just, you know, what's going on with these people. They can't even get the basic facts of these things straight. Now, let's see here. Let me find this article here. Here it is. Okay. Here's the way they wrote it up. Now, of course, as you know, what they wrote about was they say they want President Obama to sign the executive order that would protect federal contractors. Right? Well, here's what they wrote on the Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell's show page. First paragraph, right here. 37 Democratic senators have, and we read this last week on the show, 37 Democratic senators have penned a letter sent to President Obama Thursday urging him to sign an executive order to pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. No, wrong. I mean, you know, and what's even worse is if they had read the first paragraph, the first sentence, hell with the paragraph, the first sentence of the letter that they linked, they would realize that that's not the case. But they obviously didn't read the thing carefully. And they just totally screwed it up. And what's even worse than that is I wrote a comment on that page. And they still, it's just up there. They know nobody bothered to correct it. It's just they're putting out misinformation, and they don't even feel an obligation to correct that misinformation. And I'll read the comment that I wrote just for we got a few minutes left. So I'll read the comment that I wrote here. You know, I was so excited to see this on your page today. I went ahead and began quoting the piece on my own show tonight, meaning last week. That was when I realized that the author of this piece had totally screwed up the main point. In your first sentence, you say 37 Democratic senators have penned a letter sent to President Obama Thursday urging him to sign an executive order to pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act and prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. No, that's totally wrong. If you read the first sentence of the senator's letter that you linked in the article, you'd know that the point of the executive order is not to pass ENDA, which is a piece of legislation which must be passed through Congress, but rather to prohibit anti-LGBT discrimination at federal contractors. President Obama can't issue an executive order to pass ENDA. Only Congress can pass that bill into law. What the senators are asking for is for the president to issue an executive order to prohibit anti-LGBT discrimination at federal contractors, which is within his power as president, and in line with what former presidents have done by executive order in the past in regards to race, ethnicity, and religion. In all honesty, I'm not sure which is more upsetting, that the author didn't understand the facts of this story well enough to report it accurately, or that no one at MSNBC noticed so basic an error and corrected it. It makes me wonder if Lawrence reads his own show page, because surely a man with his level of federal political experience and expertise would have caught the mistake. And that's what I wrote. And it is still up there in exactly the same form, uncorrected. It makes you wonder. Do these people bother to pay attention to what goes on under their own banner? Do they even care that they're putting misinformation out on their own page? I mean, it's really disheartening that MSNBC is this sloppy. I mean, really. There's no other word for it. It's sloppy. You didn't read the article. You didn't read the letter. You didn't read anything. You just wrote what you thought it meant, and you didn't bother to check your facts before you posted. I mean, you know, any decent blogger should know better. Really. Honestly. I mean, you know, I like Lawrence O'Donnell. I think he's a great host. I like his perspective. You know, but when you put stuff like this under his banner, it makes him look bad. It makes the show look bad. And it's unworthy of Lawrence O'Donnell. It's unworthy of MSNBC, in my opinion. It's disheartening that they care so little about the kind of information and the quality of the information that they're putting out on their own show page, that there's stuff like this can get through. It's really disappointing. Now, here's another interesting little tidbit. Truth Wins Out, Wayne Besson's organization, an organization that fights anti-LGBT extremism, offered to help educate eHarmony co-founder Neil Clark Warren about gays and lesbians after he made what Truth Wins Out calls a series of ignorant comments, according to a press release. Warren recently told Yahoo Finance, "I think this issue of same-sex marriage within the next 5 to 15 years will be no issue anymore. We've made too much of it," he said. At the very best, homosexuality has been a painful way for a lot of people to have to live.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah, isn't that lovely? Wayne Besson responded, "If Clark Warren believes that the lives of gay people are inherently painful, it is probably because the homosexuals who attend his church are stigmatized, treated poorly, and made to feel inferior."
I'll say.
Yeah, totally. Let's see. What else? Is there anything? I'm looking for something else. One more. Okay. Well, we'll end with this one. In Michigan, Trenton police, that's not Trenton, New Jersey, it's Trenton, Michigan, arrested a man after citizens complained he was seen sucking a flesh-colored dildo at a local park, according to South Florida Gay News. The redacted arrest report the smoking gun obtained stated that authorities received a 911 call reporting a man was in a silver car parked inside Elizabeth Park and allegedly performing fellatio to what looked like a sex toy. The man, 67, was charged with a misdemeanor, and the dildo was confiscated as evidence.
Of course.
I'm sorry. I
can't prosecute without the dildo.
I you got to wonder. You got to wonder. What exactly is the charge there? You know, can you picture this guy going to court? What exactly is the charge? We're talking about a sex toy. So there was no real public exposure. I mean, what, he's not allowed to lick a piece of plastic? I mean, you got to wonder what the charge is there.
In this case, the crime is in the mind of the police officer only.
I guess so. It's just, you know, sometimes you read some of these things and... You just got to wonder. All right. Well, that just about does it for us tonight. I want to remind you that if you missed any part of the show, we will be repeating in about 5 minutes after a lovely musical interlude from Mr. Mike. And of course, I want to, as always, thank you for tuning in. Thank Mr. Mike for twirling the knobs. Tony Dorsey for coming on and talking to us. And thank you for supporting this media. We will catch you next week. Have a good night, everybody.